Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 73rd edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Janice de Lima, who was originally from Pakistan, a country of 209 million, formed in 1947 between Afghanistan, India, Iran, and China on the Arabian Sea. She and her family came to the U.S. when she was in her early 20s, and she continues to work and study throughout her 33 years in the U.S. and Maine, and she is now Community Reinvestment Act Officer for Norway Savings Bank here in Maine. So thank you for coming on the show today, Janice.
Thank you for having me, Kate. What a treat this is to be able to come and talk to you about some of the experiences I've had over my life.
Yeah, it's a delightful day to have you in.
Thank you.
So can you start by telling us a little bit about your upbringing in Pakistan?
Sure. So I think before I get started about myself, I'd love to take a couple minutes to just explain a little bit about Pakistan and Karachi and where I'm from
Pakistan.
Great.
Sure.
Most people would know about the British colonizing India and, you know, Pakistan and India in 1947 splitting up. But what's lesser known is that the Portuguese were, and several other European countries were also in India and had claimed different parts of the Indian subcontinent as their own. So the Portuguese had wound up in a place called Goa, took over that part of the world, and they were very fond of their religion, I think, because when they came to India, they gave us their religion and their last names, which explains why I have an unusual last name for somebody coming out of Pakistan. I'm guessing the priest or whoever would baptize an entire village at a time, and we would get the last name of the priest or maybe some of the, you know, the wealthy landowners, Portuguese landowners. And so even today you go back to Goa, which is situated on the southern coast of India, and you'll find several families, not necessarily related to each other, but sharing that same last name. There are people with names like last names like D'Souza, Fernandez, Lobo. And if you go to Portugal, you'll find similar last names even today there. So anyways, that's where my ancestors come from a place called Goa. And my maternal great-grandfather, I guess, and my paternal grandfather left Goa as young men and came and settled eventually in a place called Karachi, which ultimately became part of Pakistan. At the time, it was of independence, when India and Pakistan was separated out. People had the choice of either staying where they were or traveling to the neighboring country. And at that time, I would imagine circumstances were such that everybody decided, in my family, decided to stay on in what was then Pakistan. And we were Catholic, considered a minority, I guess, and had a wonderful early. My life was just wonderful in Pakistan because it was a very tolerant country. It was a very progressive, Western-looking country, and that's where it all began. So I've gone on a little bit about background, but just to answer your question, I came from Karachi, Pakistan, and have left there in my early 20s with the rest of my family. Came to the U.S. At that time.
Great. I love the background. I think that's super interesting, and it explains why you would be a Catholic from Pakistan.
That's right. We were a fairly sizable minority, I think maybe 5% of the population. There were other minority populations that were pretty large at the time, too. There were certainly some Hindus, some Zoroastrians or Parsis, as they're known, and several other, some Jewish people too, several other religious, people with varied religious backgrounds. One of the things I remember growing up is the church. Our church was very close to our house. It was less than a quarter of a mile away. And, every day at noon, the church bells would ring to announce, the evangelist or whatever. And we would also, during certain feast times, we would have our processions on the streets of Karachi in the town, and it was quite idyllic, actually, because we lived next door to Muslims, next door to Hindus, and everyone really seemed to get along really well. It wasn't until, I think, in the 70s when things started to shift a little bit towards a more fundamental, I would imagine, Muslim attitude. And that, too, I think, was shared by a very small part of the population. But things began to become a little more intolerant, many of us felt, many of our parents at any rate, felt the need to, leave and be more secure in other parts of the world. So that explains why most of the people I grew up with, Christians or other minorities, left Pakistan largely in the 1970s and are, have situated themselves across the globe, Australia and Canada, the U.S. And on the bright side, it gives us a place to go visit, a reason to go visit these different places and a place to stay, too, when we get there.
That is the bright side.
Yes.
The downside is Pakistan loses all these fabulous minds and people.
There's certainly that. And I feel sad because we got a terrific education growing up in Pakistan. We went to Catholic school. We went to the University of Karachi. And I felt really fortunate to have been educated over there. And I'd love to have had the opportunity to give back to the country, too. But it wasn't to be. I also want to talk a little bit about education when we were growing up. So I remember in my mother's generation, it was very largely unheard of for girls in particular to be educated beyond, let's say, our high school equivalent. And some did pursue a couple of years of college, but mostly women were expected to wrap up middle to high school and then settle down with a family, get married and have a family. That tradition started to change when I was in school, and I think our parents were, expecting their girls to go have careers as much as an education was really meant for women to be sort of an insurance policy, just in case. The expectation was their girls would be married, but just in case their husband died or was incapacitated, an education would be a nice fallback plan so the woman would then be able to go out and get a job and provide for her family. But it was not something that they were expecting girls to immediately cash in on their education and start a career. So going to school was sort of a nice to have, but not a necessary thing. I went to school with, I went to Catholic school, and we were predominantly Muslim in the Catholic schools too. Very progressive young girls. For them, there really were a few career choices they were having to make besides being wives. In fact, many of my friends, my classmates, were engaged to be married in the middle school, let's say 7th, 8th grade, and maybe 9th or 10th grade, and clearly married by the time they got to be 18, 19 years old.
Would that be arranged marriages?
Those were arranged marriages, yes. If you were lucky, you married into a family, into a man that was, caring and decent and took care of you. And if you weren't so lucky, you would have a rather difficult existence. In fact, I do know a couple of girls who, at the university, I met this young woman who was at university studying to make a career as she was eventually planning to do law. But she had a marriage that didn't work out. Her husband and his family mistreated her. Now, she was fortunate enough to have a father who wouldn't allow that and brought her home. There were not, and I don't think there still are, the sort of resources we have here in the U.S. where you can, go to a shelter for a while. You can have public housing or some sort of support from the government. Back in Pakistan, those are not options for young people, and so you're really at the mercy of your own family. And sad to say, some families would prefer their daughters suffer in silence than take on the shame of having a broken marriage. But anyways, this young woman was back in college, making her way, trying to set a career for herself. And I was really impressed with her. And you know, all these years later, I can still remember her struggle, but also her desire to do more for herself.
And her story sounds to be like an example of the changing times, where women weren't allowed careers at one point and somewhere along the way could leave a terrible marriage and make a career for herself.
That's right. That's right. In fact, when I first came to the U.S., one of the burdens, if you will, I carried for a while was, education is so accessible in the States. In California, for example, back in the 80s, I could sign up at a community college and take a course for, I don't know, $50 or so, and that seemed unbelievably inexpensive. Those courses were held at night, and it was so safe that I could go to college at night on my own. Those were not choices we had in Pakistan. Women absolutely would not be safe traveling out of the house at night to go to school. And so for many years, I found myself taking as many courses as I could just to make up for all the women I left back home that were not given those opportunities. And certainly, you know, in the U.S., colleges are so forgiving. You can enter school any time of your life. You're accepted. You're, encouraged to succeed. There isn't any stigma attached to, you know, maybe you didn't do high school or failed through high school, but you have a chance to do it all over again. And I think that's a wonderful thing about school in the U.S., whereas in many countries, you have one shot at it. And if you don't make it, then you're virtually, you know, doomed for life, I guess, if you will.
Is Urdu your native language?
Urdu is the language in Pakistan. I would say English was our mother tongue, if you will, because that's all we spoke at home. Going to Catholic school, it was we were taught in English. That has changed, and I believe they introduced Urdu as the language that you're taught. For a while, I'm not sure if it's still the case. Because it really holds people back, I think, to some extent. When I was in school, most of my Muslim friends who spoke Urdu at home insisted that we talk in English at school because they really wanted to. They saw it as a way to improve themselves and be more, with the times. These countries can't exist on their own. They have to, reach out to other countries. And the common language, of course, is English for many of these countries.
Do you have any recollections of what you wanted to be when you were a girl, when you grew up?
Yes, I do. And it might sound absurd. I had the same ambitions as any young girl does. I used to watch some American TV and some British TV. And at one point, I wanted to be a criminologist. I wanted to be a detective because we'd watch Ironside and shows like that. I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be everything I saw on TV. But then as time went on, I realized, I really want to make a difference in the economy. I had a little bit of a entrepreneurial streak and thought, oh, I'd like to have my own business. But that is more difficult than it seems. And so I decided I'd like to be in banking. I studied economics at the university and decided I'd like to be in banking and actually made a career for myself in commercial lending for many years and really found that fulfilled this need to make a difference in the economy.
Did you find banking through some of your many night classes?
Yes, I took accounting. I took some different courses in California that really prepared me for when there was an opportunity. The bank I worked with in California had a management training program, and I found that some of these courses I took really helped me when I made application for the management training program because I met the qualifications. I do remember, though, that when I first applied for work in California, one of the things I heard most frequently with the rejection letter I got was, you don't have any U.S. experience. And that was hard to accept because it's a catch-22. How can you get U.S. experience until somebody opens the door and gives you an opportunity? But, things have a way of working out. And I was very lucky. A friend of my mother's was working in a bank, and she just happened to call and say, apply for this job. It's open. There's an opening in this particular branch. And I rushed over and applied. And when I did get the job, I realized, oh, my God, I've settled for a job that is so below my qualifications. It was hard. But you know what? Sometimes you got to step back to step forward. And so that's what I did. And it really paid off in the long run. And I'm always grateful to her for making that, you know, helping me sort of be aware of the opportunity and perhaps maybe even helping open the door for me. Somebody always will be there to open the doors. And you know, and I think for anyone who's listening and has a prospective applicant, you know, sometimes just giving somebody a chance can make a whole difference in the way they, you know, the rest of their life unfolds.
I love that as a message. You're listening to WMPG, Southern Maine Community Radio, broadcasting from USM. I'm Kate Manahan, and this is New Mainers Speak. If you're just joining us, welcome. My guest today is Janice De Lima, who came to the United States as a college graduate from Karachi, Pakistan, 33 years ago, and to Maine something like 27 years ago. She's talking about her experiences and perceptions as a woman, both in Pakistan and the United States. So I'm wondering if you could go back in time. So many of my guests are more recent immigrants, and I wonder what your life was like and what your experiences were like as a young Pakistani woman just arriving in the United States.
Yeah, that does take me back in time. The first couple of things that I still remember, and I'm still a little bit sensitive about, is, you know, I came here as an adult, and I expected that I would function as an adult, but it was all so different over here. And simple experiences that, or simple tasks that people would take for granted over here were so foreign to me, I couldn't figure them out. So, for example, I was very thirsty one afternoon at work, and I had saved up enough money to, or had enough money in my wallet to buy a Coke from the vending machine. I went up to the vending machine, and I couldn't for the life of me figure out where to put the money and where to get the Coke from. And I stood in front of it, concentrated, looked at all the slots, and was just about to give up and walk away when a good friend, walked by and noticed my struggle and said, oh, did you want a Coke? And very, very discreetly showed me where to put the money and where the drink came from. And that was such a humbling experience for me because here was I, an adult, who couldn't get a Coke out of the machine. But in retrospect, I realized, you know, I'm going to have to just learn a lot of this stuff. It's all new. Back home, if I wanted a Coke, I'd go to a store, hand over my money over the counter, and some individual on the other side of the counter would hand me the bottle. But this is all new, and I tried very hard to take that burden off. Oh, I got to be perfect, and I got to figure it all out all at once. Try to lighten that load a little bit. And it made a huge difference when I acknowledged that, you know, there's some things I'm just not going to know. I remember in the office talk, you know, people use cliches and expressions that I'd never heard before. And frankly, all of the punchlines were a cliche or an expression that I'd never heard before. And I would just have to laugh along and go home.
Did you just fake it?
Yes, just fake it. Figure it out later or ask somebody discreetly later. Now, what exactly does that mean? But it comes with time. It comes with time. And
how much time do you think it took before you were understanding office jokes and dispensing machines?
Well, I'm not sure I fully understand some of them even now. But yeah, it took years. It would have to have taken years. You know, even filling gas in your car. You know, back in Pakistan, you never get out of your car. An attendant does it for you over here. But you know what? I have to step back and say, whenever I travel to New Jersey, it's like the olden days, and I figure there's a lot of people in New Jersey that don't know how to fill gas in their cars either. You know,
so. I guess you know when they come to Maine if they're from New Jersey.
That's right, when they wait.
Right. So, how did your perceptions of yourself change? You grew up a girl in a changing society in Pakistan, and you were expected to grow up and become a wife. When you came here, you realized you had limitless possibilities, and I wonder how that played out in your psyche.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say that, you know, this idea of independence and this idea of being able to stand on your own feet, I think everyone has some sense of that for themselves. And in America, you can truly, as a woman, stand on your own feet and be yourself and, chart your own course. It's not quite possible, or as I should say, it's not that easy to do that as a woman in many parts of the world. But that's what makes this country so great, I think, in that you really can self-actualize and be who you are. And whether it's because you're able to get more education, whether it's because you're among people who are willing to give you a chance, willing to, not be bound by tradition. I think that's the biggest strength this country has, is that we're not burdened by custom and tradition. People change, people adapt, and go on, and that's what makes makes life interesting over here too. Back in Pakistan, if you went against tradition, there's a price to pay, and unfortunately, a very large price to pay. So I think just being in an environment where people are willing to adapt and accept you for who you are made the world a difference in terms of having me feel like I gained independence. I was able to support myself. I was able to get as much education as I wanted for myself, and I still feel like I'm at the, let's say the last third of my life at this stage, but I don't feel like there's anything that needs to slow me down living in this country. I feel like there's another good 30 years of my life ahead of me that I'm going to learn, experience, and grow from.
You're unlimited.
Unlimited, yes, I hope.
So you grew up in a time in history when, in 1973, your country adopted a constitution of Pakistan, which ensured that there would be no discrimination based on sex alone. However, there was a conflict with Islamic law and tradition that you were just speaking about that affected those laws and how they'd be carried out by local judges. I wonder, were you aware of that as a girl?
I did follow politics quite avidly. My father did too. In fact, our whole household, we would talk every morning. My father would read the newspaper to us at breakfast, and lament this or be excited about something else. But the tone in Pakistan changed in the early 70s, and it became more. While Pakistan was always the basis for Pakistan was it would be a homeland for the Muslims, the tone changed towards a more fundamental approach to a fundamentalist approach to Islam, and I would imagine even Muslims at that time were probably a little on edge about it because faith, let's face it, is a very personal thing, and most people would practice their faith, whatever degree of faith they have, on a more personal level. But now to have government get in the way of telling you or dictating to you what your faith should look like just felt wrong, and certainly felt wrong for the minorities. But I would imagine a large part of the Muslim population would also have those same issues. Whether it's Judaism or Catholicism or Islam or any other faith, Hinduism, you can't really govern a society using the morality and the code of conduct that was used 2,000 years ago. I mean, it just doesn't work. And ideally, you take some of those concepts that most of these good holy books have laid out and try to apply them in modern times and try to lead a good life. But if we're bound by, very strict codes of conduct, very strict scripture, inevitably it's going to fall. I mean, I get disappointed when I hear this is an election year and next year too, and the rhetoric sometimes can veer towards, we should follow the Bible, or we should follow whatever in terms of approaching some of these social or economic issues. It's a little discouraging, because I think everyone's faith should be their own, and you should practice it on your own. But let's not get government too involved in how faith should be interpreted, you know.
You have personal experiences about how your life's been impacted when there isn't a separation of church and state.
Right,
so
right.
Sounds like you're looking for a little...
I hate to see us go more in that direction in this wonderful country, but I don't think there's that much of a risk. Again, this is a small minority that sort of brings up this issue. The majority of us prefer to keep our faith to ourselves.
Thank you, Janice. You are smart, savvy woman who's been fantastic. I've loved having you in the studio today, talking to you about women and justice and American dreams, and thank you so much for coming on New Mainers Speak today.
Thank you for having me, Kate, and this was just a wonderful experience, and I would reach out to all those new immigrants in Maine or elsewhere and get to know Kate, because she's awesome.
Oh, I second that. Anyone's welcome to contact me at the website, which is newmainersspeak.com, and I'd love to have you on the air.
Thank you.
I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, Janice de Lima. We'll close today's program with a song she's chosen for us, and I'm looking forward to you introducing this to our guests.
This is a song sung by Zoe Vikaji, who is the daughter of someone I knew growing up in Pakistan. And she's great. She blends Eastern style, and I hope you enjoy her music.
Thank you.
यादें भिगोई हैं आंखें हैं नम मेरी